morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, and sitting across from me, or sort of across from me, is
Klaus von Stutterheim.
And we're going to be talking, we're going to be doing actually something we've never done before. And we're going to rebroadcast an interview we did with Eric Olin Wright back in June of 2013. A very, very interesting and original figure. We kid him a bit about being the only Marxist we've ever been able to get on the show, like, you know, 8 years of doing shows. He's a brilliant and original thinker. And so we're going to play a little later the half an hour interview that we did with him in 2010. Eric Olin Wright was the Yiddish term is a mensch. He was widely beloved by everybody who knew him. He was a family man and very concerned about his family. When we tried to interview him in 2010, he was trying to deal with elder family issues. And so I think we did one interview he didn't call in. The next one we got him. So we joked that we had a whole half an hour to talk about his work without having him around to correct us. So then in June of 2010, we got an interview with him, and we recommend it to folks. I mean, right now, the whole width of the discretion in the United States, whatever they call themselves, is basically between liberals and conservatives. And Eric Olin Wright doesn't sound like any kind of normal Marxist. Certainly like none of the guys I ran into in the 60s and 70s who were very dogmatic and preached and yelled at me. What he is a critical thinker. It's called critical Marxism, and he tries to use some of Marx's basic ideas, both early and late, to understand how society could be better. Anyway, I recommend you all listen to the segment when it comes up. He died last week of leukemia. He was about 70 years old. He had published 100 academic papers and 21 books, if I remember correctly. I may be a little wrong on that, but I think that's pretty much his output. He was the sort of dean of sociology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which at one time in the 70s and 80s had the best sociology school, probably sociology department, I should say, in the country. So that's Eric Olin Wright. And so we hope you enjoy his interview. I hope you look at his books, because it's time now in dealing with Trump and this long reactionary regime to think what we want to do next. Suppose Trump is not elected, and suppose the Democrats elected. What do we want to do to get a society that is fairer and more equitable in terms of power? So Eric writes, what his concern is not so much the distribution of, okay, it's not so much the distribution of money as the distribution of power. So he wants to see how he can keep a country like the United States, where everybody has a reasonable variation in power. So if you're an activist, you're going to have more political power than somebody who isn't. If you give money to campaigns, you'll have a little more power than somebody who isn't. But right now we have this incredibly skewed system that is warped and twisted by money and by all kinds of negative things like gerrymandering that democratize the United States. And so what Eric was looking at was for deeper ways to change things. So the debate between democratic socialists, liberals, and conservatives, he wanted to go underneath that. He wasn't, at least in the books that I read. And that's a good thing, to have someone thinking really radically, or trying to think in a really radically different way. Because we're rapidly reaching a situation where, Well, you see the crisis in the U.S. You see immigration is bringing all kinds of right-wing regimes, right, Klaus, to power.
Yeah, it does in Eastern Europe.
So what Eric Right would probably see, I think, is the threats, and I don't want to speak for him anymore, but is the threats to democracy both in Europe and in the United States. I mean, Donald Trump has no respect for democratic values and traditions. And in Poland, we have the same situation. In Hungary, the fellow there has managed to reorganize the whole system so it supports his political party. Turkey was never a clear democracy, but it's fallen into more and more
authoritarianism.
Yeah. So we have a world, and instead of in 2013, we have a world now where authoritarianism seems to be spreading, and the democratic socialists, you want to call them that, they're not really, all the societies in Europe are economically capitalist, folks. Every single one of them. There are no socialist societies in Europe, and I don't think there ever have been. What they are is a capitalist society with a strong social net, with a redistribution of income to try to modify and soften the impacts of capitalism. Because if you look around you, you can see the super rich. What was the guy? Do you remember, Klaus? The guy just bought the top of a skyscraper in New York, a penthouse for $238 million. I mean, the system has gotten crazy. And the percentage of wealth controlled by a small group has gotten more and more and more and more. So how do we get to a society which is more democratic, where everybody really has a more equal say? And if you, in talking to Wright, it's not an absolute thing. He doesn't want everybody to have the same income. But he wants the income distribution to be, narrower and fairer, so that you don't have a bunch of billionaires and a bunch of impoverished people. You have some sort of better balance in that. So, I think that with his death, that it's time to rebroadcast the show that we did with him. Also, if you go on the website on it's the June 10th, 2013, or you put in Wright's name on a search, you'll go right to the interview that we did with him if you want to rehear it. And that's a good introduction to his work. We're focusing on his book Real Utopias, which is a as he says, a provocative title, because a utopia doesn't exist by definition. Utopia actually in Greek means no place. So no place are there utopias. And I guess Wright's question is, let's look at utopias to see where we might be able to go. So this is really intellectually really interesting stuff. I don't think, unless you're the owner of vast economic wealth, it's any threat to anyone. But he's looking for that kind of society. And what's happened, of course, since the 2013 interview is that the society has become less democratic. Wealth has gotten more concentrated. Basically, and the things that were concerning him have gotten worse. And We're in a situation where we don't know what questions to ask. I mean, is there a way to get beyond capitalism's very rough and crude and unfair distribution of wealth? I mean, we're accepting a whole lot of things that we really don't have to accept. We accept that the owner of or the manager of a corporation gets 300 times that income of the workers in the corporation.
Well, Steve, if you look at the Western European model, you have something that comes a lot closer to what the author's talking about, because number one, you have a social safety net where when you retire, you have enough money not to live not to really live it up, but enough to live comfortably and without fear. You have free medical care for all. You have free universities for all. And the chairman of big companies don't make these outrageous amounts that companies would do here. It happened once at Deutsche Bank, and there was a huge outroar across Germany. This is just not done. So we're in Western Europe, we're a lot closer to this than we are here. My thoughts are that if the Democrats get elected, they've suddenly, you know, we've seen some, quote, big ideas, right? Medicare for all is one of them. And free tuition is another one. And that's somehow, that's going to have to be paid for no matter what anybody says. And I remember when I first entered Wall Street, which was in 1972 or 73, the top tax bracket was 90%. And at that point, the population was, it was much more equal. And there was also an estate tax that you couldn't just pass on incredible amount of wealth to the next generation. You had to, the tax was, if I remember correctly, something like 50%. So the system was much more egalitarian. And I think this is what Democrats are beginning to talk about in the 2020 campaign. And if anything like that were to happen, that would be a long way towards what you're talking about.
There has to be some way. When the Supreme Court made the decision that corporations were people, bad decision, and when they made the determination that basically corporations could give infinite amounts of monies to political campaigns, what happened is to accelerate the distortion of American economy. And so you have thousands and thousands, I think everybody knows this, of different kinds of people in Washington trying to influence things for particular groups, lobbyists, basically. And you'll see that one thing that the Trump administration does is taking a lobbyist for the oil industry and place him in charge of monitoring the oil industry and so forth and so on. They've taken the foxes and put them in charge of the hen house. So that's the difficulty. And the question is, will the United States system keep working as well as it has, or will it get more distorted than it is? And will these European social democracies, because they're not really socialist, there's no socialist aspect hardly to any of these economies, will they all survive? The impact of the immigration is worldwide. So if you have a country like Sweden and everybody is Swedish, you have a kind of solidarity built in. And when you get a whole bunch of immigrants, maybe it'll destabilize that solidarity. And then people, there's always a group of people who move, or xenophobic, it's called. Does not dislike new people, dislike foreigners. That always gets accelerated in times of economic crisis and change.
Well, I have, maybe it's because of my heritage and when and where I grew up, but I have high confidence that that Germany will survive as a democracy. Yes, there's some right-wing people who hate the immigrants, but as they're screaming, the immigrants are slowly getting integrated into the economic and social system. So I strongly believe that Germany will survive as the kind of democracy that it is.
The question is, how do we get to a more open, kinder? People don't ever ask this. How do we get a kinder, more gentle, more supportive society, a society that enables everybody in the society, or at least tries to? Because some people can't be enabled. Let's be honest about it. But a society that, you know, like, so free public education is an example of enabling people. But now we have a system where our students accumulate extraordinary amount of debt, which keeps them from, when they get out of school, from buying a car or getting a house, or people are postponing marriage, all this kind of stuff, because they don't have enough funds. And so that's the question we're trying to get to with Eric Olenreich. This was broadcast in June of 2013. Gary LeMaster has a wonderful write-up of what he said. And, you know, we deal with a lot of interviews with a lot of people in 7 years. It'll be 8 years in April. And Eric Olenreich was a really nice person. And some of the people that we agree with politically are pretty cranky characters.
Well, I look forward to hearing the show, since I haven't heard it.
Okay, so we're going to broadcast the show now. It's from 2000. Oh, I've got a minute. All right, we're going to broadcast the show now in just a few seconds. I think you'll enjoy it, and you can always find all our work on our website, bvid.org. You can find the whole thing if you want to re-listen to it. You can find Gary's brilliant discussion of it, and you can see three of us trying to deal with a lot of new and different and complex ideas. Guys who have not written 100 academic papers or 21 books. So anyway, here's going to be the broadcast with Eric Olin Wright.
Today we have Eric Olin Wright in. We had a long discussion about Eric's book a couple of weeks ago.
The elusive Eric Olin Wright.
Without him available so that we could say anything we wanted to.
Yes. Right?
Now we've got the author here. You know, and Tom was saying before the show that hearing is sort of overvalued because we only listen to ourselves anyway. Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Well, welcome to the show. And let's introduce Eric a little bit, and then we'll let him talk about his book, Envisioning Real Utopias. Eric is a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin. He's the past president of the American Sociological Association. And I believe the association devoted a whole conference to the ideas of your book, Envisioning Real Utopias, did it?
Well, I would say the conference theme was derived from the idea of the book, but it wasn't really about the book. The theme was Real Utopias.
So let's talk about that, because utopia is a term coined, I think, by Sir Thomas More, what, about 1512, something like that, and it means basically from the Greek, no place. But so envisioning real utopia seems like a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, it's meant to be a kind of provocative oxymoron. The Thomas More word, it was actually a pun, because there are two Greek roots. One means no, and the other means perfect. You know, you and ooh. And so he coined utopia to mean the perfect no place. So I put real next to it to imply that we should think about how to create real alternatives that could actually exist in the world, that have empirical traction, that are viable, and yet constitute a fundamental alternative to the way we do things. So it's meant to be a provocation in that sense.
And we really need those alternatives because we have a mature and developed a political economy that has foreclosed many alternative approaches to things. And I might add, not everybody is happy about it. Everybody from the Tea Party to what's left of the left has some real problems with the system that we have, capitalism and representative democracy, particularly lately, after this last financial crisis, there seems to be some question about how viable they are in the future.
So here's the basic problem that we face in the world. The world as it is seems to create great damage both in the lives of people as they experience everyday life, but also for the long-term health of the planet itself. You know, we're facing very grave dangers globally. It all seems out of control. The powers that be, so-called, themselves don't seem in control of a system that constrains the kinds of lives people want to live. And yet it just seems impossible to imagine how you could get out of this box, how you can create an alternative. Older visions of doing that, you know, the kind of revolutionary fantasies of the 20th century, had this idea that you could have a sharp break with the world as it is to create an alternative. I like to use the term rupture to describe that vision of transformation. And that produced catastrophes. It did not produce human emancipation, a world where people could live flourishing lives.
Talking about the idea of the socialist revolution that
right,
was so popular
right.
in the 19th century
right.
amongst working people.
And literally millions of people fought and died for a utopian vision of socialism. And across such great suffering, there's been a collapse. I guess, our first official socialist on the radio program.
Right.
We often get to be called socialists here because we're slightly to the left of Richard Nixon. But you're an actual socialist. But you don't sound like a socialist back from the day when they're very dogmatic guys we would be arguing with.
Well, you know, the word socialism has an interesting history to it, of course, like all words. Words have histories. They collect baggage. Sometimes the baggage gets shed. It's interesting, in a recent poll by the Gallup organization, 18 to 29-year-olds in the United States have a more favorable view of socialism, of the word socialism, than the word capitalism. 49% had a favorable view of socialism and only 43% of capitalism in that age bracket. And partially, I think that's an ironic effect of the Tea Party attacking Obama for being a socialist. That helped to rehabilitate the word. The word then has a positive meaning for people who think Obama's not so bad. So, you know, words have interesting histories. Socialism was introduced as a word as an alternative to capitalism. It always had a kind of ambiguous content to it. What exactly were the institutions of the alternative? Then in the course of the 20th century, what happened was an attempt at building an alternative occurred in extremely unexpected contexts, the least advantageous settings in the world to try to build some viable alternative to an economic order such as capitalism. And the word became associated with what I would call statism rather than socialism. That is, the word became associated with a way of imagining an alternative in which the state controls the way we organize our economic affairs, rather than ordinary people democratically participating and controlling their lives. I see socialism as fundamentally an extension of the idea of democracy from the political arena to the economic arena. It basically says ordinary people should control their destinies as much as possible in whatever ways and in whatever venues their destinies are shaped.
Well, wasn't the idea originally that, and held by many people, not just the people we identify historically as socialists, wasn't the idea that you cannot have equality in political affairs unless you have a relatively equal distribution of wealth? I mean, one of the things that's said about capitalism, it's very good at creating wealth, but not terribly good at distributing it. It tends to concentrate it amongst the people who have the power to direct economic affairs.
But, you know, I agree with that point, of course. I think equality of material, relative equality, not absolute, but, you know, relatively equal conditions of life are crucial for political equality. But my emphasis would be just slightly different. I think the key issue is equality of power in all of the arenas of life where our destinies are shaped. So what it means to have a socialist economy is one in which ordinary people participate in making the decisions that shape their affairs in the economy, just as they do in ordinary politics. The economy is a political arena. That's why it's called political economy, not just economy, because power is exercised in the allocation of resources. And this has massive effects on everyone's life. And that's the fundamental idea of democracy. You know, democracy is just the simple principle that people, to the extent possible, should have meaningful participation in decisions which affect their lives. If those decisions only affect you as a separate person, then we call it liberty. You know, you can make decisions over your life without asking permission of anybody if the decision only affects you. But if it affects masses of other people, they should be part of the decision as well. I think a term that kind of captures that idea is self-determination. And that's what we want for an economic order, is an order of self-determination of individuals.
Right. Well, isn't that also sort of, in the end, a management problem? You know, how to manage complex affairs with greater participation. I mean, one of the principles of efficiency always seems to be that you can't have a room full of people making critical decisions. I mean, and this is a, it seems to me that the difference between governance and management here is crucial in analyzing our existing institutions.
Eric, yeah. We're getting a lot of clicks on the line, so our beloved technician has given me a note that said, try to keep the phone really still.
Okay, I will. I
Sorry
will
about
stop
that.
Fidgeting with my phone.
Yes, no fidgeting with phones.
Okay, I'll try to be as fidgetless as possible.
Our beloved technician has sent down the word.
Okay, how's that? I am now...
Perfect.
Holding an absolutely still phone.
Getting back to Bill's question, actually getting away from Bill's question, but he's going to ask it again. At some point, in your materials, you talk about race, gender, and religion. And in a real utopia, those things shouldn't have any effect on political power and political direction. But they do in capitalism. So at some point, we want to talk about what is there about capitalism that makes things like race, gender, and religion twist things so much, and how does your vision of the real utopia get around that?
Okay, so I don't have answers to every questions, and I don't have a one size fits all view of what it means to build an alternative world. There's a slogan that's been kind of emerged in the last 15 years or so, connected with something called the World Social Forum. Another world is possible. I believe another world is possible. The world we live in isn't the only possible world. Mm-hmm. And another world is possible in which human beings can live flourishing lives to a much greater extent and much more universally than exists under our order, our existing order. Now, the fact I focus on the kind of political economic aspects of these issues, I don't think that's sufficient to solve all the problems, particularly problems around race and gender and the inequalities which are rooted in those systems of social interaction have a certain autonomy. But that the harmfulness of gender inequalities and racial inequalities gets intensified by the way they intersect economic inequalities.
Right.
And they get reproduced by the way they intersect economic inequalities. So my general approach to these matters is to focus on these economic power relations, not because in and of itself that solves everything, but it's a way of making other problems more solvable. Now, on the question of religion, I think it's important to distinguish the role of religion in people's lives as a grounding for meaning, for purpose, for a sense of how one fits into the universe, the role of religion in people's lives, and the role of religion as an institution that gets used by centers of power for particular purposes. I have no problem whatsoever with religion and spirituality as a dimension of human life, of part of human flourishing, and of as being at the core of the way people grapple with the deepest dilemmas and problems of existence. What is problematic to me is when religion gets hijacked for political purposes.
Right.
And that's something which happens from time to time in the United States. We've had various waves of kind of religious fervor that then impinge on politics. When it does so merely through the way it inspires individuals, then it's just one of the many ways that people's lives get inspired. When it gets mobilized as a political force through the use of resources and strategies of mobilization, I think it's quite a different matter.
It seems to have no place in a real utopia, or at least what you're describing, it doesn't have an outsized place in a real utopia.
Right. It occurs internationally, too. I mean, you can see the Russian Orthodox Church is supporting Putin, has become a political leg of his power in Russia.
Sure.
So it's not a a local issue, and it's not an issue with one particular economic structure.
Well, Bill's management question, although these many hours ago, go ahead, Bill.
Let me back up a little bit. Yeah. I want to talk about, or I want to ask you about the real part of the real utopia.
There you go.
And I think that dovetails with my earlier attempt at distinguishing between management and governance. We want people to have some input over things that affect their lives, but we don't necessarily want to run a nuclear power plant by committee, right?
Right, absolutely.
So when you talk about developing institutions that allow for more participation and encourage more participation in decision making, you talk about the principles of viability in the first place and achievability in the second place in your book. In other words, when we move from a utopian idea of what we want, then we have to think about concretely in terms of institutions, and we have to know whether or not these institutions will work, and if we think they will work, how do we go about setting up examples to prove it, correct?
Right, absolutely. So I mean, here's a kind of a straightforward example from the real world, and it's the contrast between the way capitalist corporations work and the way worker cooperatives work. Now, mostly, worker cooperatives are small, and capitalist corporations tend to be large, and it's easy to think that the difference between the way they function is mainly a question of size. There are, however, worker cooperatives in the world that are also large. In Spain, there's this very well-known industrial worker-owned firm, Mondragon, which is has no outside investor. It's 100% owned by its worker employees, its worker members. They do have management. It's not the case that all decisions get made by giant meetings of all workers, but the management is accountable to the employees, not to outside investors. And strategic decisions, decisions about new lines of investment, about new initiatives, about major changes in technology, those get made through committees in which ordinary worker owner members of the firm sit. And then they get voted on by general assemblies of workers as a whole. So, of course, there's complicated management issues to be solved. And you do need forms of representation as well as direct participation.
Right.
It's just that we have a system of workplace dictatorships. We are, you know, in the United States, we're comfortable with saying, yeah, we have democracy or some form of democracy outside of the firm, but in the firm, totalitarian systems are just fine. A boss can tell you what to do, and if you don't like it, you get fired.
Right, my way or the highway, right?
Right.
But Mondragon does operate overall in a capitalist economy, yes? I mean, they decide what to produce based on pricing signals and so forth, just like a regular corporation would, don't they?
They operate in a market economy as a non-capitalist firm. So I think it's important, and of course our market economy is dominated by capitalist firms, and thus we can call it a capitalist economy for sure. But I think it's important to distinguish capitalism from markets. Capitalism is a particular way of organizing markets. It's a way of organizing markets in which capital itself is privately invested for purposes of maximizing returns. And so you can be an owner of a corporation in which you don't even know you're the owner of, so to speak. You just invest your money there and you don't care what goes on inside. A cooperative market economy is one in which the entities which do the production are all owned by their employees. No outside investors.
Right.
Democratic governance within the firm.
Right.
And then the question is, from a kind of simple economics point of view, is this going to be more or less efficient than a capitalist market economy? There's always trade-offs. You know, a simple-minded view, and this is the way socialists used to talk about it, that all the virtues lay with a democratic socialist alternative and all of the evils with capitalism. No, I think they're trade-offs. Mm-hmm. I think on balance, the efficiency gains from having a democratically organized form of economy way far outweigh whatever efficiency disadvantages they might have.
Right, right. Let's assume that that you managed to seed a number of these cooperative organizations throughout. How do you see the political implications of that in terms of changing of laws and so forth? I mean, how do we get to the point where organizations like this become viable in the sense that they look like genuine alternatives or replacements for the type of economy that we have now?
So, of course, that's the big question. If we can imagine worker cooperatives as a substantial improvement, both for the quality of life of people inside the firms, but also for the economy as a whole. Let me just make one little comment about that, and then I'll address how do we get from here to there.
Right.
One of the advantages of worker cooperatives, of worker-owned firms, as the central way in which we organize enterprises, is that they are geographically rooted. You don't have to worry about a worker-owned firm deciding to move its production to Mexico. Because they live there. And so when they encounter problems, the central task is how to solve the problem in order to retain your viability where you are. That makes those kinds of firms much more invested in building local networks, local supply chains, local embeddedness. That's the kind of sociological term that's used to describe that kind of production system. That also makes it easier for those firms to be democratically accountable to the wider community, not just to their members, because they don't have the possibility of escaping.
So the economic decisions are not divorced from the political decisions.
Absolutely, right. So that's why it's part of creating a democratic world, a democratic economy, not just a democratic firm in terms of its internal governance. So a worker cooperatives as the central form of economic organization creates a very different macro environment for the micro activities that individuals and firms engage in. Now, there's still the question, how do you get from here to there? My feeling is what we have to do is think about the ways in which, particularly in local and regional economies, we can create more space for cooperative forms of enterprise. Some of this involves public policy around credit markets, for example. One of the difficulties that worker cooperatives have is that workers typically don't have a lot of capital. They don't have a lot of savings. And worker cooperatives are often highly undercapitalized because they have difficulty in getting adequate credit. Well, that's a solvable problem. It's not the case that we can't have public policies to create a favorable credit environment for particular kinds of firms. We do that all the time. We could have public policies that would favor geographically rooted worker cooperatives as a form of enterprise. There's also a very special circumstance that we're in for the next couple of decades, which is interesting in this respect, which is there's a very large number of small and medium-sized enterprises in the United States that are privately held firms. They're not joint stock companies. They're not corporations in that sense. They're family firms, basically, of baby boomers who are aging out.
Right.
And a lot of these firms face what is sometimes called succession crises. Their kids don't want to take over the firm.
Right.
They want to get out of the business. Well, what do you do? Well, one of the things that you can do is you can sell your firm to your employees. We do have a mechanism for doing one version of that, ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans.
Mm-hmm.
ESOPs are different from worker cooperatives because they still operate on the principle of a corporation of one share, one vote,
right,
rather than one person, one vote. So they're not democratic in the sense of a worker co-op.
Let me ask you this. Right now, you know, one of the things that people who talk about things like participatory democracy and so forth have to confront, it seems to me, is the passivity of a lot of people. You know, if you work for a living, the last thing you want to do is go to a meeting after work to decide, you know, how your company is going to be run. And I wonder if the passive nature of a lot of people with respect to these sorts of decision-making scenarios, is it because we have become accustomed to a consumer economy where, you know, we don't participate? Is this something that can be changed, or is this something inherent in the nature of large groups of people?
Well, first of all, the idea of a worker cooperative does not mean endless meetings taking up all of your evenings. The worker cooperatives have committees, and the committees meet during work time. So, partially the way worker cooperatives work and other democratically run organizations is building into the fabric of work the participation rather than seeing the participation as something you do outside of work. Nevertheless, participation is a demanding task. I'm not meaning to say it isn't. And there are times when, of course, it means the work spills over. The experience of people who work inside of worker cooperatives is that it is not a major burden. Worker cooperatives, when they're well-run, also have well-run meetings. You know, people develop skills at these things. I'm not convinced that people in the United States are so deeply enamored with the consumerist lifestyle that they are unsuitable for participation.
Well, certainly there is a lot of political activism in the United States at the moment, both from the left and from the right.
And it's not so much enamored as it is deadened, I think, by just the assault of consumer capitalism. You have so much fascinating stuff in your work, and again, you know, we're talking about changing systems, and even just your discussion of capitalism versus statism. Once more, I think it's worth mentioning that for a lot of us, or at least a lot of Americans, the experience of socialism, as we understand it, is really statism or Soviet-style statism. And as we certainly have a failed example of that to look at in the last generation or so. In talking about going to the worker cooperative, we're also talking about, you mentioned the rupture aspect of going from one style of economy to the other. And that certainly is a no-rupture method. And so bottom line here, in the little time we have left, Eric, we're talking to Eric Olenright, one wonderful book, and Envisioning Real Utopias. And here on Democratic Perspective, we like to talk about utopias. We do a lot of negative politics on here because we live in Arizona, for one thing.
Might be easier to find the book online, folks, than offline. And
why
is that? Northern Arizona.
Like a good socialist, I think about, we got 2 minutes left. Like a good socialist, about three quarters of it is available free online. At least I found an awful lot of it online. I would like to have, and indeed I'm going to have the solid book, but.
Let's ask Eric, how would you sum up your book, Envisioning Real Utopias? You talk about bringing the social back into socialism.
Yeah.
How would you sum up your book? You've got about a minute and a half.
Okay, so I think the key idea is democracy. The idea of bringing democracy down to earth in the fabric of everyday life, including in workplaces. Democracy combined with pluralism of institutions, experimentation, many different forms that this can take, rather than a one-size-fits-all vision of how you should transform the world. And also then finally the idea of building the alternative world you want in the world as it is, and doing so in such a way that moves you towards the alternative. That can happen without it requiring a transformation at the top in the first instance. You can begin by building in communities, in neighborhoods, and doing all sorts of things that are completely unexpected. An example I give in the book is Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a real utopia. Wikipedia destroyed a 300-year-old capitalist market in encyclopedias.
We're out of time, Eric. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
This podcast will be available, Mike.
Yeah, on vvid.org, vvid.org. This podcast and all our podcasts are on.
And we'll put a link to this book so that you guys should go and buy it and read it for yourselves.
There you go. There's a lot there, and it's all worthwhile. Thanks, Eric.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.